The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Improvisation at the world-famous Second City Theater. This podcast is about navigating work and life without a script. Improvisation is a practice in collaborating more effectively, tapping into your full creative potential, and building ensembles who can both support and challenge us. If you like what you hear, please rate us on iTunes and share the podcast through your social media channels. Help us extend the conversation. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tight and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back. Hey, Julie.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Keiko Agena. Keiko is an actress best known for her role as Lane Kim on the TV show Gilmore Girls. She has appeared as guest star on shows such as NCIS Los Angeles, Shameless, and 13 Reasons Why, and will soon debut as a cast member of The First, which I'm really looking forward to. She is a graduate of the UCB and Iowa West improv programs, rest in peace, and currently performs on multiple teams around Los Angeles. She and her work have been featured in Entertainment Weekly, The Hollywood Reporter, and more. She also has a new book. It's called No Mistakes, a workbook for imperfect artists. Keiko, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
So someone asked me to describe your book, and I said it's like if improvisation met the artist's way with elements of mindfulness and design thinking. And these are all compliments, I want to make sure you know, but I'm wondering...
Oh, wow.
Am I all right, so that's somewhat accurate, right?
That's great. I take that as a compliment for sure. I'm obsessed with the artist's way. I love the artist's way.
Yeah, and I've yet to get Julie Cameron to return any of my emails, so thank you for doing that, because I'd love to have her on. But this is what I love about the book is that, you know, it has got really sort of lovely phraseology. There's art. I know, so I'm terrified of like drawing stuff. And when I've done work with IDEO, they're always making you draw. And I realize then I do it and I have fun. I'm like, oh, this is what happens when we make people do improv. They feel the same way.
Right, exactly. A little bit out of your comfort zone, but then amazing things happen, hopefully.
Yeah. So in addition to acting and improvisation, you're a visual artist, and you write at the beginning of the book that, quote, justifying mistakes is how I draw. And I'm curious if that came to you before improv training or after.
You mean drawing in, as a whole, or the idea of looking at drawing that way?
Looking at drawing that way, this idea that the mistakes are part of the work.
Yeah, you know what? I think it just all happened organically, because the way I started to draw were really just doodles. They were always doodles, and they were always just for my enjoyment. And so I didn't realize that I was incorporating those improv elements into it until afterwards, a year afterwards, and I kind of looked back into it. Actually, as I was putting this book together, started to see the correlations between those two things. Because the drawings that I make are very abstract, and I don't sketch anything before I start out. Mm-hmm. So it's really just literally line built on the line before, built on the line before, and the piece of art sort of dictates where it wants to go, as any good improv scene would be as well.
Right. I ask that because I know, you know, when I started at Second City, and I started in 1988, I really wasn't aware of the whole improvisational elements. I knew it as a comedy theater. And then as I learned about the improvisation stuff, I'm like, oh, wait, because I'm a musician and I was into jazz and the Grateful Dead. And I did my thesis on Jack Kerouac and spontaneous writing. And I'm like, it feels like all the things that I had been working in were leading me to then understand, oh, there's an actual practice I can attach it to. And that was kind of mind blowing.
Yeah, I've been obsessed with improv for years. I mean, I was on a show, Gilmore Girls, and I, even before Gilmore Girls ended, I probably took my very first class at Groundlings, mm-hmm. and then ended up, in the RIP iOS. Yes, iOS LA is no longer.
No, but we still have it in Chicago. So the flag's
still
here.
No, you do, and I hear it's an amazing facility.
Yep.
Hopefully, I'll get out to Chicago sometime soon and get to see it all.
So, all right. So this book is, a lot about mistakes, right?
Yeah.
You say no mistakes, though, I think it's a little tongue-in-cheek because one of your quotes is, your ragged edges are what make you great. And you talk a lot about using your mistakes, that mistakes can be actually a sort of a powerful way to move the story forward.
Yeah, that's sort of the philosophy of the whole book. And I think that's one of the brilliant things about improv is that, if there's a mistake, that's oftentimes the thing that everyone latches onto, and it can become the brilliant moment of the scene. And I thought, well, what if I could actually live my life with that kind of compassion, and not only just compassion, but just joy and celebration? And so I thought, well, I would love to write a book with that as the base philosophy of it, and then see where it leads me. And a lot of the exercise and all of that just was born out of that that idea, where really genuinely it's a lot about being a little bit easier on ourselves, because I think I can be fairly critical with myself. And if I just would just get out of my own way, then better things will happen. And that's definitely how I, my problem with improv as well, is just getting out of my own way and then letting something interesting come about.
Yeah, it's like we're constantly fighting with our fear and shame brain, and,
yes.
Improv's like purposeful, but then you realize, oh, I'm doing this in my relationship, I'm doing it, with friends, it never stops. And there's this is always an area that, like, particularly in the business world, trips people up. And I think it's because it's extremely hard to keep two opposite ideas in your head at the same time, but improvisation kind of gives you practice in doing just that, so it's easier for improvisers to understand that mistakes and failures are inevitable, and at the same time, their gifts on a path to success. But I actually, and I know this for myself, and I imagine you do too, when I'm out of practice and I find myself not improvising, I move right back to what I was like before.
Oh, yeah. That's definitely true. My biggest hang-up, I think, is just like, hugging the back wall. I think that's probably my default of a bad habit, if I were to say. And it's funny too, because, it's just like a couple months pass by and you're like, oh, how did I ever think I could possibly do this thing? Like, how was I ever brave enough to step on the stage, to improvise? Mm-hmm. And then, you do it, and it's great, and it's fun, and it's all, it can sometimes just kind of, disintegrate. If you are able to meet up with your, people that you've worked with before.
Totally. You also write, and I think this is tied to what we're talking about, you write in the book, when you're tired, rest. When you're tired, keep pushing. And I have this thing I keep saying, both things can be true. And I think that's what you're getting at, is that you really have to, and improvisation makes you sort of agile in the moment to, sometimes you need to rest, sometimes you need to keep pushing. And that's going to waver at different times and go back and forth.
Yeah, I think that's the fascinating thing about improv that keeps me coming back, is that there's so many rules, and they all can be broken. It's totally dependent on that particular show at that particular moment in that particular circumstance, and that's why it's this puzzle that's almost never ending. It's fascinating, and I don't know if I'd ever become bored with it.
Yeah, no. I want to ask you about, there was a quote in the book that I think I know what you're getting at, and I just thought it was really lovely, and you say, quote, "The pain of wasted time is a monster." And I want you to unpack a little bit of what you're talking about with that.
Oh, sure. Well, I think that sometimes we try to avoid pain by just not thinking about it or putting it outside of, just numbing out.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is that it doesn't really go away, and that as time passes, that buildup of pressure becomes its own kind of pain. And then at some point, it's you can't ignore it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's difficult when you realize and you look back on the amount of time that you've spent just in avoidance. So I always think, it's best to just kind of face it now, because it's doubtful that it'll go away, and over time it'll just accumulate and be way more difficult.
Yeah, and this is where I think I pulled this from the section where you were talking about failure, and you write, fail now, fail soon, fail often. And it's funny because I went to my book, Yes And, because I have a whole failure thing, and I wrote in that book, fail together, fail fast, fail free of judgment. I think all these failures, they're all true. But it's this this idea of and you have a great Japanese proverb, which is fail seven times, stand up eight. I just think that's a terrific framing, right?
Yeah. I think failure is just it's just a part of it. It's going to happen. So we might as well get used to it. I mean, I think that it may be even a good thing that in the line of work, you know, as being an actress, you're just it's part of your life.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of your weekly life. And so if you don't make friends with it in some way, there's no way to survive, I don't think. There's no way to have a long career in it because it'll just it'll tear you up too much. And so I think that that taking the fear away from it and just realizing that everybody's going to do it, it's going to happen to you, and that the sooner you do it and the sooner you can find some kind of joy in it, the easier it's going to be. And it's not odd. That's the other thing. It's like to fail is not odd. And I think maybe it's because maybe we don't talk about it as much. We don't post about it on Facebook.
Right.
You know, it's like, but it's happening to everyone all the time, every day. So it's not weird that you're failing. It's just that we're not putting it front and center.
Yeah, with the exception of comedians. Because I mean, like,
true. Yeah,
no one's success is funny. You know, the only thing that's funny is everyone's own failure.
Oh, yeah.
And it's not my failures that are funny, right? It's this other person's.
I think that's
interesting too. It's like we have this. It's like stress, right? Stress in itself is not bad. It's only bad when we're getting stressed out, but we use stress to heighten our performance. This is what athletes do all the time. And I think as an actor, I mean, I've worked with actors for 30 years. This is such a thing because, man, oh man, you are putting your personal self out time after time after time. And if your audition rate were a batting average, like you're all hitting in the hundreds.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not good.
But
that's the nature of the game, and it has nothing to do with your worth. And so if you can then sort of train yourself, and again, improv does this, it gives you a kind of a resilience, a kind of attitude of useful failure I'm going to use this in some regard. And I think that's what you get at with a lot of your tasks as well inside the book, is finding ways of almost tricking your brain into being more positive and to not falling into old traps, right?
Yeah. Because I think it's a habit of thinking. If we don't try to address it, then we're just going to be in, you know, whatever habit we've grown up with, and using whatever tools we developed when we were younger. So I think that if we can just find a way to get a new skill set, then that's something that we can use as adults. Because it's like a method of working. It's how do I work? What are the skills that I need to be able to move forward in my creative life in a way that's going to be joyful and not stop whatever creativity that is already in there and already wants to come out and bubble out to be smaller.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, and I want to talk to you about some of these tasks. So it's a workbook, and sometimes that can be hard to talk about, you know, over an audio medium, but we're going to try. So one of them you titled Be the Idiot, and you write, do you ever look at someone having a joyous moment and question their intelligence? Somewhere along the line, we have equated cynicism with intelligence. I love that. And want to talk about a bit with you. What do you unpack again for us? Something around being the idiot.
Yeah, well, I think that happens a lot of times in comedy. Also, you know, we're kind of trained to be so quippy and so sarcastic, and I think a lot of times in social media it's like that. Also, there's everything that's quote unquote smart is tinged with a little bit of negativity. You know, it has a little bit of a bite to it, What I fear is, like, when that's the diet that I'm ingesting and that's what I think is that I equate that with intelligence, and saying that anybody who is just expressing pure joy is not observant enough. That's, I think, of I don't know, for myself, I think it's a dangerous thing, because I put people who are keying into a joyous moment or really wholeheartedly absorbing something in a freeing, fun way as being dumb or naive. It's a sad way to live, I think. As I go on with life, because that just cuts, it's just like cutting the legs off of any momentum that you want to have.
Yeah.
You know, to try to incorporate that in a real way in your life.
Yeah. No, that's very true. And I think, you know, because you've worked in the comedy scene as well, the snark can overcome.
Yes.
And then you
right?
meet.
Yeah.
And then you meet meet people, you know, I think about like Keegan-Michael Key is an example of someone who worked at Second City who is an ultimate right. joyous presence in a room. And then you look at the talent, you're like, he's not sacrificing anything in the talent area by also choosing to be kind in the personal arena.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great example. He's just so fabulous.
And loud. You can hear him coming a mile away, which is also, it's like Keegan's in the building. He's the loudest human being.
Yeah. He makes his presence known. Huh?
Yes. So another task I want to ask you back about, you title it Daydream Positively. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I wanted to have examples in the book of things that you could do immediately. Everything is immediate. So it really, to be honest, it's a little bit of a trick. So it's a kind of way to meditate, really. It's like, how do you get little bits of meditation in here in different ways? To just take a breath and to just take a moment to think about your life in a positive way. And the other thing I think, I don't have my book in front of me, but I think underneath it too is like, it could also be framed as daydream gratitude.
Yeah.
Of like taking out all the things that, all the negativity that automatically comes into your brain and flip it to, well, what can I actually be grateful for in this moment? Lately I've been finding that that's something that I've had to sort of force feed myself a little bit, honestly, to get into a mindfulness of gratitude. It's awkward. It's like stunted. It sounds stupid, but I'll force myself to like think or say certain things to myself in a, when I'm feeling particularly selfish or down on myself, and it will work eventually after, you know, a few hours or something, but it'll flip on its own. But at first, it can feel really clunky to do.
There's some science behind this. So one of the initiatives that I work on is with a behavioral science group at the University of Chicago. Nick Eppley, who's one of our scholars there, in a very early conversation, he goes, if you're feeling bad, do you know what the best thing is to do? Is to do something nice for someone else. That they have sort of data and evidence behind the idea that you like just saying good words, I guess it's like a mantra, right? Or even more, doing good actions are actually the things that are going to propel you. And that made me think about with this, when you talk about daydream positively, Adam Grant's work, the Wharton professor, he writes in Originals about the power in procrastination, giving yourself the ability to sort of just live inside your thoughts a bit and be okay with that, because you can often come out the other end with insights that are maybe a bit deeper because you've allowed yourself just kind of play inside what might seem like a weird thought or an unwelcome thought.
Yeah, I think it's great to not have to structure everything in our days so much that we leave space that's not where we're not ingesting media all the time also.
Oh God.
I'm
the worst on that. I talk about it all the time and then I'm on Twitter like 5 minutes before I'm talking to you. The worst.
Right. I know.
So you write in the book that you're anxious a lot. And I'm curious about that. Are you saying I'm anxious like every other person? Are you more than that?
Well, I sort of say that because, to be honest, I'm a little bit obsessed with a thing called the Enneagram, which is like a personality type system. It's similar to Myers-Briggs, but it's just, you know, what type of personality that you have. And the one that I most closely relate to, one of the things that is a defining characteristic of that particular type is an anxious mind. So I I assume that I have perhaps more of an anxious mind than other people, but I think that having an anxious mind is something that a lot of people do have to some extent and can relate to. But I probably, yeah, I have more of an anxious mind. I'm a little bit of a Debbie Downer if left to my own devices.
Okay.
You know, I sort of feel like my superpower is being able to see what will go wrong with everything, potentially. But that's not actually a superpower. That's just something that sometimes I think that is my superpower.
You might find this interesting. So I was at a conference last year, an improv conference, and I was talking to Aretha Sills, who is the granddaughter of Viola Spolin. And and she said, you know, Viola's original name for the exercises was not games, and it was not exercises. And I said, what was it? And she said she called them problems.
Oh.
And so, yeah, so if you think about it, too, so her orientation was that I'm presenting problems that through these exercises you're going to solve. I think that correlates a little bit to this idea around an anxious mind and interest in sort of uncovering something, and it might be a bit uncomfortable, but that's okay. I'm going to push myself to do it.
Yeah, I definitely think that's sort of my my default mechanism is a kind of curiosity and interest in something, perhaps sometimes to an obsessive extent. I do think that probably the only reason why I shouldn't say the only reason why, but one of the reasons why that I've had the success that I've had is that I'm also very bouncy, like resilient.
Yeah.
As far as I will fail flat on my face, but give me a day and I will, like, let it go and come back as hard as I can.
That's interesting.
And run against that wall.
Right, right, right.
Full force.
I also want to, this is like such a beautiful sentence. I want to quote it. You say,
thank you.
You say, quote, this is about your anxiety, wrapped up in a future scarcity, a fear that there will come a time when I will need something and no one will be able or willing to help me. And this this idea around scarcity is huge. And in my study in the work, it's a rather recent thing, but recognizing that we're all suffering from this idea of scarcity. There's not enough time to do our work. There's not enough food for people. There's not enough. And it is so daunting in front of us. And I do think improvisation has something to say about that. And I don't know that we all know what the exact links are, but it feels like there's it's almost sort of like practice for battling against scarcity. I don't know, something like that.
When I watch the people that I love the most in improv, there's a kind of relaxation that they have where they know that they have everything that they need in this moment, and they know that they have everything that they will need 5 minutes from now.
Right.
And there's not this tension of this stress about it. It's a lovely, beautiful thing to watch because I'm watching it unfold, and they're watching it unfold, and there's no holding on about it. They're just in it for the ride, and it doesn't feel like it comes from a place of scarcity. It feels like it comes from a place of fullness.
Yeah. I'm curious too. Like do you remember when you first experienced improvisation, and was it I'm assuming it was as an audience member in some regard.
Yes, I'm trying to remember the very first. One of them must have been in the loft at IO West in some very. I think these were very early days when I watched an improv team. But I mean, when I saw the Smokes for sure, a UCB team, that's one of those teams where I just die every time. There's never a bad show.
Yeah,
there's never a bad show, which is a crazy thing to say. But to me, I never have a bad show. Because the thing about improv to me, and this is a little bit selfish, but as an actress, but as an Asian American female, 44-year-old actress, the brilliant thing about improv is that I can be anyone. I can I can be cast as your sister.
Yeah.
You know, I can be a dog. I can be an alien. I can be a 99-year-old grandfather, and And that's so freeing, you know, as opposed to having to fit into a very, you know, a specific box when I'm out in the world auditioning as an actor.
That's so interesting they bring that up. My wife is a longtime Second City educator and director and all that, and we've been talking a lot about the reverse issue of white, especially white male straight performers and identity as they improvise. And are they allowed now to play people of different religions or races? Or is that, and so it's on the other end, it's tricky.
Yeah.
So you just having you, Sarah, talk about the joy is like, oh, yeah, that is joyous. And on the other end, knowing, you know, when I came up at Second City, it was still four white guys, two white girls in like every, you know, cast. And I was lucky. I was lucky enough to produce the very first gender equal cast at Second City. And then, you know, we became better. We haven't solved anything, but we're at least better.
And
I remember seeing when Tina Fey and Rachel Dratch did their Dratch and Fey show, and they completely... all of that show was exploring sort of female identity, where they played a variety of different female characters, and was so refreshing and different. And the two of them are so effortlessly skilled that it was really. And it's funny you mentioned Debbie Downer, because you know that's a part of Rachel. She's got
right. Oh my God, really?
Oh yeah. She's like,
that's so funny.
Rachel was constantly in my office with, well, I didn't get SNL this time, you know, and she didn't. And actually, the reason she got it was Tina coming back and doing Dratch and Fey with her, and Lorne coming back and seeing that, because he had to, because Tina was going to be his head writer. It was so blown by her.
Right.
Because, you know, you don't get, if you don't get hired by SNL and they fly you out, it's not like that ever happens again. They won't take you. So this is one of those rare situations where it was so in their face that they took her. But yeah, she has a lot. She had a lot of doubt. She's actually, I think, now kind of grown out of it after writing her book and having a kid and, you know, seeing the successful career she's had. But, you know, even the most acclaimed performers, Renee Fleming, who I've worked with, suffers from stage fright. I mean, it's like, it doesn't stop because you're brilliant or really good.
Right, right. Because I think sometimes it just shifts.
Yeah.
Because now you're more famous and people are looking at you and more people have an opinion about what you're doing. So I think that it changes when you are more well-known, that it doesn't go away. And a lot of times it gets even worse because you have more eyeballs on you and you have more people who have an opinion about your work and whether it's good or not, or whether it's, you know, all types of opinion. And so you have to almost build up your confidence to another level when you become more well-known.
Yeah, I think that's true. The other thing I have found, here's something I want to ask you. I don't have this in my notes, but I just thought of it, which is I have worked both in the theater world, a little bit in the TV world, and in the improv world. And I tend to find that improvisers on a whole tend to have a little more sort of patient kindness than actors do. And I might be biased, but I'm curious what you think.
Wow. You know, it's hard because I know so many of both groups.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that I could say for one way or the other that I would find more patient people in one group or the other. I think there are, well, in my experience, I think there are great people and terrible people. both sides.
Yeah, fair. That's fair.
Yeah. But I will say that I do think that whether you're great or terrible, it only gets more pronounced with fame.
Yes, 100%.
Yeah.
So we're going to ask you for a yes and story in a moment. But I have a couple other like quotes that I pulled from the book that I just want to get kind of a quick take from you because they sort of were interesting to me. One was, quote, "There does come a point when you need to kill the teacher's voice in your head." What do you mean?
Yeah. Well, my teacher said that to me way back when.
Huh.
So I'm taking it directly from her, really, is that at some point, you have to go out on your own, and you have to find what will work for you personally.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's very important, especially with acting, because the teacher dynamic with acting and improv is like this too, is there's this I don't want to say heroism, but there's this dynamic where you really get attached to your teacher, and you almost have to in a way, because they're guiding you into some very vulnerable places.
Yeah.
So you have to trust them in a way that you wouldn't necessarily trust someone that's teaching you Excel or something like that.
Yeah.
But at some point, even that person that you've put so much loyalty into and so much trust into, in your mind, you kind of have to, kill them off so that you can give your own voice and whatever your own voice and gut is telling you to do to have the prominent space in your mind.
Yeah, well, that's because they're more like a master in that regard. And I think that's true of people who in any art, like I think in terms of the old apprenticeship idea of a craftsman sort of mastery and then artistic mastery. I think in sports, you've got these sort of incredible coaches who help develop talent, but then eventually you've got to sort of leave that voice. So I think that's true across other fields as well. Okay, one more. The other one I wanted to get your take on is, quote, allow your adoration to lie lightly upon you.
Yeah, I feel like sometimes we can appreciate people so much that it stunts our own growth, where we think, oh, I could never draw something as brilliantly as that person drew it, or I could never perform improv as well as this incredible performer does. So you just compare yourself against them so often that you just criticize yourself into a little crumbly mess, or worse, you don't even start. You say, well, I could never be that good, so I won't even try. So I think it's necessary to have those people that we love, and that's what gets us into doing whatever craft we're into. But then we have to, think of them as kindness or a light influence and not something that is so such a yes or no or black or white of how well we're doing at any particular moment.
Yeah, that's really sage advice. I mean, not everyone is going to step out and be the world's greatest improviser or violinist or baseball player.
Right.
But just because you can't be Michael Jordan doesn't mean don't play hoops. That's crazy. Okay,
right.
So we're coming to the end. And I don't have to tell you what yes and is because you lived it, learned it, continue to do it. But I do want to see if you've got a yes and story for us.
Oh, sure. When I was thinking about this, I thought the main one that I couldn't get away from really is honestly this book itself.
Mm-hmm.
Is that, originally, well, first of all, I never thought I was going to write a book. This wasn't on my radar at all, but it started because I was obsessively drawing. So I would doodle and draw just for my own self, my own sanity, really, as therapy to help me as an actress to have something that I could create and post. And so it had a beginning and an end, something that I had control over. And that was really my relationship with art. But then some people would say that they would do a coloring book if I offered it. And I would get that comment a few times. And so I just happened to mention this on a podcast I was on the Gilmore Guys podcast. And someone from Tartar Paragi contacted them. And that's how this whole thing started. And I will say that a lot of the book, as far as like getting over my own fears, actually happened in the very beginning of deciding whether to do this or not at all, is feeling like, well, you know what? I don't know what's going to happen, but I'm going to try. I'll at least do this very next step and then see what happens from there. I'm not putting any eggs in this basket, but I will do this next pitch. So I did the pitch, and then I liked the pitch, and then it developed into much more than a coloring book. It became the book that I wanted to have. It needed to be something that I couldn't get rid of, like if I was doing a purge or something for my house. It would have to be something that I needed to have in my space.
That's great. And there's nothing, I can't think of another feeling that I've had when I got my galley in the mail and the very first one, right? And you're like, oh my God.
Yeah, oh my God.
I did this.
It's so weird.
It's amazing, and it's a thing. And this is the other thing, because we work in a medium where we don't make things, and you're like, well, I made a thing. So the book is called No Mistakes, A Workbook for Imperfect Artists. Keiko, thanks for coming on the show.
Oh my gosh, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate this immensely. It's amazing. Well, I've been working.